This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Thousands of curious visitors have made the trek out to Lucama, North Carolina. It's a tiny town near Wilson that's mostly farmland with just over 1,000 people. But the visitors are here to see the whirligigs, sort of giant windmills about 6 stories high, 50 feet wide, with hundreds of small moving parts. And they spin in the wind. Bala Simpson has made the whirligig famous. He's a prominent artist whose work was shown at the 1996 Atlanta Olympic Games and outside our own North Carolina Museum of Art. He died earlier this month at the age of 94. We'll look back on his career and the impact of outsider art in North Carolina. Roger Manley is the director of the Gregg Museum of Art and Design at North Carolina State University. Chris Vitiello is a freelance writer for the Independent Weekly. And you can go to our website to see Vala Simpson's work at WUNC.org. Roger and Chris, welcome.
Good to be here.
Thanks, Frank.
Roger, you have been curating shows of outsider artists for decades. Wallace's work has been among them, and apparently the first. Was Wallace's work the first you showed?
Wallace's work was in the first exhibition I did, which was with the North Carolina Museum of Art back in the mid-80s, about 1985 or so. We did a show called Signs and Wonders, which was all about outsider art inside North Carolina, and his work made the cover of the catalog, and we set up one of the examples of his windmills out in front of the museum. And it really was his first introduction to the art world and to the world of museums and all that. And everything has been going along since.
Talk about that introduction. Was it a hard sell? Did you have to convince him he was an artist? Did he want to come to the museum? How'd that go?
He actually adapted to it fairly well. I mean, one of the things about Wallace is that he was used to solving problems and used to taking on big challenges. And he really almost acted like he'd been waiting for someone to come along and do that. So it was really went okay.
But, Chris, he hadn't always seen himself as an artist. Is that right?
Well, I think that he eschewed the term pretty actively, but I think at the same time he was really I think he was kind of amused by all of the attention is what I've heard. There was one time when I in 1992 I went and had a conversation with him and I was trying to ask him, you know, with my art history background, trying to ask him some probing questions. And he just wasn't too interested in it. You know, I was saying, well, this is reminding me of this person's work or this person's work. And he just, this just wasn't a background that he came from at all.
How did he get into it?
Well, the legend goes that he always, you know, he's just one of these naturally talented engineers, lacking in training, but just intuitive. So, you know, one of these people who probably took something apart as a little kid and could put it back together and it worked better than it did the first time. So when he was serving in the Second World War, he set up one of his first, I guess you could call it a whirligig. It was definitely a wind-powered machine to power his Air Force company's washing machine. And once he got back to the States, you know, he was sort of repairing small engines and also moving houses on those big rigs. It's sort of hard to know what kinds of wind machines he was making, although I think he powered some machines in his house with propellers in the air. But really in his mid-60s, he started looking around at all the scrap that he had in his yard for these jobs and started making these whirligigs.
Tell us more about those jobs, Roger, because that was, I mean, he moved some immovable objects.
I mean, that was what he did for a living, as well as being a farmer and repairer of farm machinery and stuff like that. Was he had this kind of niche that he created for himself, which was picking up extremely heavy things and moving them. So, like, if a factory needed a huge piece of machinery lifted out of the middle of the factory and carried over all the other machines, they'd call Wallace. Or if a hurricane blew over a water tower, Wallace was there with his cranes. He built 13 cranes himself could rig up ways to lift whatever needed to be picked up and set it back in place. If a combine got stuck in a field, they'd call Wallace. And he built a 200-foot-tall radio tower himself with a welding torch, and his wife used it. She was the dispatcher and sort of dispatched him on all these runs, and really that's how he kind of throughout that part of the state, he was known for moving heavy things.
So tremendous ingenuity, very, very practical.
Yeah, I mean, Chris mentioned his just natural talent. I mean, he was kind of a folk Archimedes
Give me a lever, right?
Yeah, give me a lever. Or I always think of Orville or Wilbur Wright, too, that sort of person who can is not afraid to try something and try something big, but using his own hands to do whatever he needed to do.
And what really knocks me out is that these objects are handmade objects, but they sure don't look like it. I mean, when you look at the housings that he's built and how, you know, how a bearing housing has a post coming into the back of it, they don't look like these sort of spontaneously hand-done objects. I mean, they're very well made. They're very precisely made. And they last forever out in the elements. They're really kind of remarkable.
I mean, I think one of the things about his stuff is that how delicately balanced it is. It's hard for people to wrap their brains around how big the stuff is, for one thing. I mean, it's huge. Some of the windmills are the size of railroad locomotives, and yet they just the tiniest little breeze, they'll spin around and face the wind and start moving, and they have this wonderful sound that they put out with kind of a clanking, bell-ringing type sound.
I wonder how much you knew about him and his work, because we know more about him today, and we've probably, whether you know it or not, somebody has seen work of his outside a museum, certainly North Carolina Museum of Art. But before you knew much about him, what was it like for you to see that his work for the first time, to go out there and take a look?
Well, I have to say, when I was curating that show for the North Carolina Museum, someone said, you should go take a look at this place in Lucama. I think you'd be interested in it. I went out there with David Steele, who's the curator of European art at the North Carolina Museum of Art, and he and I traveled around together to do this. And when we first went out there, I mean, I have to say it was mind-blowing. It was really something to come around a curve and suddenly see a field, an entire corner farm intersection with about 30 or 40 huge pieces of machinery all just moving and not really doing anything other than sort of dazzling the eye.
Let me ask you about that, because I can imagine. I mean, I'm imagining that scene.
Well, what I was going to say is that one of the things that was really great is to go out there at night. Because they were completely covered with highway reflectors and parts of old highway signs, so at night it was hallucinatory. I mean, it really, really was something.
But what about that transition? You talked about these things that really aren't doing much but dazzling the eye. This is a guy who was engaged in some very, very practical activity. I'm picking up heavy things. Nobody else can do this. That, to me, seems like the transition, not the ingenuity, not being able to build these things, but make something that isn't going to do anything. Was that a big change for him?
I'm sure it was. I would argue that that these objects do something. I mean, they're so aesthetically exciting, and they just convert the slightest movement of air into really spectacular motion. I think they're so playful. Thinking about somebody who had been doing these types of things with his hands for his whole life. He's, you know, at the age of 65 or so, maybe moving out of the sort of work cycle, and he needs stuff to do. So another important practical consideration is this kept Wallace Simpson working for 25 plus years.
He didn't really begin until he was in his 60s, and then I think he really felt like he needed a legacy of some sort. That he'd done all this stuff for other people. And what did he have to show for it? You know, I mean, great. You know, I moved that brick building 3 miles down the road and set it up on a new foundation, that kind of stuff. But there was nothing that was specifically his. And I think he felt that need to really leave a mark and to do something big.
Where is he on the timeline of outsider art? And we can get into a fist fight over whether there is such a thing and what it means. But I guess, roughly speaking, people not trained in art who produce works that end up in galleries and we like, I don't know.
I don't know about whether there is a timeline. I mean, I think people have been doing this for hundreds and hundreds of years. at least since the Industrial Revolution got started. But I, outsider art wasn't named outsider art until 1972, first book that by that title.
And where does Wallace Simpson fit in all that?
And Wallace just it's just one of the greats. I don't know how to. You know, where it's what?
Yeah.
Did he do anything for the scene in North Carolina? Was North Carolina a kind of a center for outsider art?
Well, there are a lot of outsider artists all that are they're widely known all throughout the southeastern United States. And I mean, I think I remember sort of seeing, you know, catalogs and websites and lists back in the 90s and you know, when the internet started really kind of gathering momentum and information started getting there. And, I mean, he was one of the stops. If you were taking a swing through the southeast, get off 95, make sure to see the Whirligig guy just south of Wilson. It's an important location on that map.
Mm-hmm. The Whirligig?
Yeah, I mean, I really consider him probably North Carolina's greatest sculptor, not just outsider artist, but a sculptor of any sort, an equivalent to any, you know, sculptor in the country. And, you know, so if there's a place, I think he belongs in the whole art world.
Chris Vidiello is a freelance writer for The Independent Weekly. We're also talking with Roger Manley, who is director of the Gregg Museum of Art and Design at North Carolina State University. And just ahead, we're going to talk about the rise of outsider art in North Carolina. You can take a look at much of the art we're talking about right now at our website, wunc.org. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Earlier today, we were talking about prominent artist Wallace Simpson, who passed away earlier this year. He constructed giant windmills that have been featured at many prominent art exhibits. Simpson went into art late in life. He really didn't think of himself so much as an artist as a guy who liked to fix things and work with his hands. And he's part of a larger movement of outsider art. Roger Manley is the director of the Gregg Museum of Art and Design at North Carolina State University, and he's been involved in outsider art since the 1970s. Pam Gutlin is the owner of Outsiders Art and Collectibles in Durham, and she joins us now. And you can look at the work that we've been talking about at our website, wunc.org. Welcome.
Thank you. I wasn't even alive when Roger started looking at outsider art. Just kidding.
You were, yes, you are. You are kidding. But I only know that because you said so. Tell us about, we talked a little bit about this question of outsider art. I mean, when it became, I mean, obviously people have been making art, whether they were trained or not, forever. Mm-hmm. But it became a thing and galleries and museums started to care about it, as you said, back in the 70s. I mean, tell us about that phenomenon.
Well, it really began overseas in France with Jean Dubuffet, who was the first major artist to go around and, you know, start collecting art made by people who didn't realize they were artists. Now, he had the idea, he called it art brut or raw art, and he had the idea that this kind of art was made by people who were social isolates. So he went to places like insane asylums and prisons and very, very remote communities and looked for people who were really kind of outside of society, cut off from everybody else through their mental problems or their just their situation, and began collecting work from them and exhibiting it and traveling around. He had exhibits in New York and Paris, and eventually his collection settled in Switzerland. And he was really the sort of beginning of this whole thing, and that was in the 1960s, I guess, that he was doing most of his collecting.
Well, tell us about an artist named Annie Hooper.
Well, Annie Hooper was my introduction to this whole thing. When I was about 17, I went on a camping trip on the Outer Banks. I was really looking for a way to get away from the rest of North Carolina. And back then, the Outer Banks were pretty far from everything else. Now it's a lot more
accessible.
Well, that's
why we have South Carolina. You could have gone even farther.
Right. But I went out to the Outer Banks and over the winter time, and it turned out to be a big mistake. I mean, I was hitchhiking. And the weather was terrible, and nobody likes to pick up a big wet person, you know, standing by the road. So I stood there hour after hour waiting for something to come along. And then eventually a truck slowed down. I got in the truck and started to I was just trying to salvage my trip. So I asked the driver, you know, like, what can you do out here? And he said, well, you can go down and maybe collect some seashells. And I thought, well, you know, that's not a good idea because I'm walking. I didn't want to load myself down with a lot of shells. He said, you can go to look at the lighthouse. And I'm not really big on heights, so I stayed away from that. And then he said, well, maybe you should go see my grandmother. She does these kind of wood carve things. And my ears perked up at that because I hadn't done any Christmas shopping yet. So I thought, well, I'll go buy some duck decoys or bookends or something like that. And, you know, that'll be something. And at least it'll be out of the rain. So he dropped me off at this house in Buxton, right at Cape Hatteras. I went up and knocked on the door, and this little old lady opened the door. She had a silver white hair, kind of a bob haircut, and she just invited me in like she was waiting for me to show up. And as soon as I went into that house, I can say my life changed. I mean, I looked, when my eyes adjusted to the darkness in the house, I could see thousands of faces looking back at me. And this lady, her name was Annie Hooper. Annie had filled her house with 3,500 or so concrete sculptures, concrete and driftwood sculptures that she'd made from scraps that she'd found on the beach and things like that, and they were incredible. Wasn't making it to sell. From the outside, the house looked totally normal, but inside was this whole other world. And I got back from that trip, and I tried to tell people about it, and nobody could quite envision it. So then I began, realized I had to take some pictures. So I went back out a few months later, took photographs of it. And something about showing those pictures to people began triggering memories of theirs. I'd say, like, oh, I know somebody like that. There's a guy in our town who's making chainsaw sculptures. Or, oh, I know somebody who's building windmills out on the country road. Or, you know, or you should go see this guy who's collecting mule dung that looks like the presidents of the United States.
You know, but twice as smart.
Yeah, so yeah. I started to follow up and just it really wasn't a goal. I didn't really set out to do anything like this, but I just thought they were fascinating people. I wasn't really even interested in the stuff they were making. It's just the stories of who they were and what they had done.
Well, Pam, what about that? I mean, the stories, the idea that, and as Roger said earlier, this movement gets started by looking for people who are outside the normal in their behavior. Mm-hmm. I mean, how important is that to the story of outsider, the attraction to outsider art?
Well, I think it's really the difference between a more traditional artist and the outsider artist. That's what piqued my interest, were the stories. It's great if you love the art as well, but as Roger was saying, it's the people. They're so interesting, and they come from such a different background, and they don't think of themselves as artists. They think of themselves as tinkerers, or it's a hobby for them, and it's their way of telling a story that they couldn't tell otherwise. So for me, that's far more interesting, the story part.
And is that the art? I mean, you know, we're going to get into this conversation about the art itself versus the story and the art. But I mean, doesn't every piece of art to connect with us somehow have to be a kind of a narrative? Don't we have to make, as somebody who's going to appreciate the art, it's got to make a connection with me somehow.
Right. Well, I can connect to art that I think is beautiful or interesting, but it's the outsider artist's story that actually draws me in and makes me love the art or be moved by it in a completely different way. If they didn't have the story to go along with the kind of art, it would just be art to me. It wouldn't necessarily be as interesting.
And what about that story, the idea of the eccentric, or perhaps somebody who is, and here this seems to be part of the attraction, they may have a connection with that world that I want to know. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's something in this picture.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think people want to find something that means something real. And unfortunately, a lot of contemporary art is, you know, made by people who go to art school and set out to become trained artists. They get their MFA, and then they, you know, they're looking. There's a very much of a professionalism about it all. And, you know, how do you get a gallery? How do you get a dealer? You know, what do you do? You know, what kind of ad do you put in Art in America and all that sort of stuff to kind of build a name recognition. Mm-hmm. And then you're basically trying to turn your art into some kind of a commodity or something. And I feel like that when this general interest in outsider stuff came along, it was because that other approach had progressed to such a degree that people were a little tired of it. Yeah. I think they were really just, you know, okay, you know, I understand what you're saying with what this, you know, this giant black painting means, but, you know, what is it saying to me? And, you know, who are you? And, you know, why did you do this? Well, you know, there's very little way to answer that question sometimes.
That word authentic or authenticity seems to be attached to outsiders frequently, right, Pam?
Absolutely. And it's a struggle. I think Roger's probably experienced this too with some of the emerging outsider artists, the younger ones, because back in the day, it was much easier to find somebody who really had been sequestered from traditional media and the environment and really did have their own thoughts. And nowadays, you know, with the internet, you can sort of learn how to be an outsider artist. I do have a lot of younger artists coming to me saying, I'm an outsider artist. And I'll say, well, why do you say that? Right. Here's my website. And I do have some of those. And some of them are genuinely good, but they don't have. And I don't want to say, well, I do want to say they don't have the same kind of struggle or the same something that what their aha moment that that a lot of the masters had. And so it's really interesting to sort of try to figure out what is your story and is your story something totally subjective. So is your story something that I feel is unique?
And it doesn't even have to be true. I mean, tell us the story of Black Joe Jackson, right?
Right. Well, Roger, I don't even know if the story about this is even true, but so Black Joe Jackson, one of the first artists that I ever saw and collected was an artist named Black Joe Jackson. Supposedly, he was an African-American man who grew up on a farm, and he was dyslexic, and he used his art to tell his stories and his memories of growing up. And they're beautiful pieces. They are, and I still think they're beautiful pieces, regardless of the story I'm about to tell you, which Roger can confirm or not. And I do remember, this is before I had a gallery and before I knew that this was where my life was going to go, but I do remember looking up information about this artist because you usually can find something. And there was nothing. There was this one paragraph that the few galleries that were selling his work had, and everybody was using the exact same language. And there was no ad-libbing. That was it. And then I opened my gallery and somebody came in and said, oh, you carry Black Joe Jackson. I said, yes, he's one of my favorites. And they said, have you ever met him? And I said, no, actually, I've never been able to meet him or find him. And they said, that's because he doesn't exist. At which point I thought, you've got to be kidding me. I mean, I had 20 pieces and had, you know, really fallen in love with this person and the story and had told the story and had learned to recognize the way that he wrote his name because he used the traditional dyslexic reversing of the letters. And apparently Black Joe Jackson is we don't know who, Roger may know who Black Joe Jackson is, but he is not an actual person. There is an artist out there who has created a persona and given the persona the story and the name and the style. And
I actually know it. He's Banksy.
Right. Well, it's a very similar kind of, you know, it's. Right. And so then I started to second guess everything. And now when I work with, you know, with the emerging artists, of course, I always meet them and I will do what Roger's done all of his life, travel far and wide to meet them and document. But and I still get to this day, I still get people calling me saying, you know, I have some Black Joe Jackson. Will you sell them for me? Or I'm looking for Black Joe Jackson. And
will you now that you know?
No, I don't sell his work anymore. I tell them the story. Yeah. And the sad thing is I still do love the art. Yeah. So I would love to know who the artist is, because I would love to buy that person's art. I think, you know, whether he's an outsider or a trained artist or a folk artist that just realized that, you know, the money lies in, you know, having this interesting story. I would like for him to step forward.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked a bit about story, and yet it does, after the after you get the story part out of the way, you still have to go back to the art. And
it's,
there's plenty of examples of people calling up or who have identified themselves as these artists, and they'll tell these terribly sad stories about, you know, how they were, you know, the alcoholic father and mother, and, you know, they were, their house burnt down, and the little sister died, and all this stuff, and then, but if the art is no good, you know, then it's still, you know, it's just a good story.
Art is at the root of artifice, and if the story worked on you that way, and you saw the and the painting did something to you, in combination with the story. Isn't that the art?
But I mean,
and
we kind of accept this in literature. I mean, you have Mark Twain. You know, I mean, these names where people have taken on these personas and sort of play them up, and as long as it's as long as everybody's in on the game, it's sort of okay.
That may be part of
and
it.
I would still buy art that I loved. I just wouldn't put it in the classification of an outsider artist.
Right.
So let's talk about somebody whose biography we know a little more about, Clyde Jones here in Bynum.
Yeah, well, Clyde kind of fits the classic profile. And after I visited so many of these people, 300 or 400 of these kind of artists, I started to realize that there was definitely a pattern to the way they the stories they would tell about their lives. And almost always, I mean, there would be some kind of tragic event or cataclysmic thing that would happen shortly before they became artists. And they were usually people who were paid in some sort of piecework basis, or people who did some sort of physical thing, like a logger who could look and see that I'd, you know, cut so many cords of wood today, or a textile worker who'd made so many towels or whatever. And then over a period of time, they kind of value themselves by the amount of work they do. And then something happens, like a industrial accident or an illness, or their, you know, the factory closes, or their spouse dies, or one thing after another. And then for a tiny percentage of people this kind of thing happens to, they're thrown back on their own resources, and they're having to do something, you know, to make up for that. And Clyde is like a classic example. He has a house down in Bynum, about 15 miles south of Chapel Hill, which is surrounded by dozens of animals that he's made out. He calls them critters, made out of just found wood cut with a chainsaw. But before that, before he started working, he was a handyman, and one day was cutting a tree down, made a mistake. The tree broke his leg, fell in the wrong direction, broke his leg in several places, and during that during his recovery, you know, he started to sort of probably was feeling depressed, no longer able to work, no longer able to be a member of the community, and then one day was about to throw some wood in his wood stove and recognized a little animal face in one of the pieces of wood. And it's something about that just set him off. He began attached a body and some legs to it and made a critter. And that felt satisfying, so he did it again and again. And gradually he's now filled up most of the town.
And yet he won't sell any of them.
Yeah. And they're not for sale. Yeah.
No, he will not.
He will
sell
make them.
Them
available for auction, for charity, and that kind of stuff. But he's really another one of the greats. We're really lucky in North Carolina to have so
well,
many.
If your theory holds, I mean, logging is one, and of course we had some timber here in North Carolina. Manufacturing would be another industry, and so you might see that in this most industrial of southern states, North Carolina. But then you would expect to see a lot of outsider art in, say, Ohio and Michigan.
And you do. And there's quite a bit in the Midwest and all. It's not concentrated to in just North Carolina or places like this. It's really anywhere where people work with their hands, I think. And it's not – you don't tend to find it – I would be surprised if you found it in Silicon Valley or, you know, places where people are manipulating information.
Right.
It's not the kind of thing that insurance actuaries or bankers tend to do when they fall. You know, that's not.
No, they write poetry.
Yeah, it's that idea, exactly. But it's that sort of notion of making something and, yeah, you know, being used to just trusting what your hands can do.
People mm-hmm. still interested, Pam?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of purchasing?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think that outsider art collecting right now is sort of at the forefront of the collecting world. It's pretty huge. New York does a huge outsider art fair every year. I mean, it's really all over the world.
Paris is having the first outsider art fair in Paris now.
Wow.
Yeah, this year.
Philadelphia's the Museum of Art there is, I think it's still up right now. They did an entire show on outsider art. It's still really big. I think it's actually now getting to be bigger. I think in terms of finding the artists, maybe not. That's going to slow down a lot. But I think in terms of accepting it, people are really starting to accept it and realizing that the art can actually be considered museum quality.
You suggest, maybe people are going into it now. I mean, you know, Roger's saying, well, you know, something happens, you worked with your hands and I've got to do something else.
Right.
But now that it has been an industry and we've been exposed to it, people can choose to become outsider artists.
Well, that's where
something.
That's where you get the a little
Comes
bit of
a
the,
very interesting issue.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it really is. I mean, you can make up an incredible story and
or imitate the work. Imitate
absolutely.
That rustic kind of outsider appearance
absolutely.
And it becomes kind of a question of what we're judging here. Well, thank you both for being on the program. Pam Gutlin is the owner of Outsiders Art and Collectibles in Durham. Roger Manley, director of the Gregg Museum of Art and Design at North Carolina State University. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you
so much.
Coming up next, we're going to talk about a new artist who has just shown an exhibit in Durham. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We've been talking about outsider art in North Carolina, and now we would like to introduce you to a new artist on the scene. Ishti Kaldor is a painter in Durham. He recently exhibited paintings for the first time ever at the Carrick Modern Art in Durham. Like many outsider artists we've heard about this hour, Ishti went into painting later in life. Doctors diagnosed him with bipolar disorder in college, and he found painting to be a kind of therapy. His work is characterized by the highs and lows common to the disorder. Ishti Kaldor is here now, and you can see his work at our website right now at WUNC.org. With us also is the Carrick's curator, Laura Ritchie, and I want to welcome both of you to the program now.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Frank. It's good to be here.
Ishti, tell us about when you first started painting.
All right. That's a loaded question, but I'll try to sum it up in like three.
Okay.
All right, so basically I was hospitalized at UNC, and I started painting with food, ketchup, mayonnaise, mustard, relish, so on and so forth, you know, the condiments. So unfortunately it couldn't be preserved, and I wanted to submit it into the gallery at Brushes with Life mm-hmm. at UNC, and couldn't do it because, well, food rots.
So. there you go, yeah.
And soon came acrylic paints, and I started painting with brushes at UNC, and then I carved my first palette knife out of bamboo with a plastic knife.
Describe your work. What does your work look like? How do you? Yeah,
sweet and sour barbecue. That's my style.
Sweet and sour barbecue.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
It's like a slab of ribs. You know, with some thick barbecue sauce slapped over it. And that's kind of how it feels when you paint.
You have a couple pieces here, and you're right now that you say it. It does have that feel. Had you been doing painting or any other kind of art before you were diagnosed, before you were hospitalized?
Yeah, I did a lot of Marvel comics, you know, your typical kid works that, mm-hmm. you know, adolescents go through. And I did caricatures, and I did one painting a long time ago of a harp, this fat woman playing a harp.
Now that's all mostly drawing. This stuff is really visceral and tactile, and you can you can feel the textures with your eyes when you look at your work now. So that's much different than the early stuff you were doing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's still in the same vein. It's just I think I've created a different school, I think.
Well, let me ask Laura a question. Laura, you're the curator at Carrick. How did you come across Ishti's work?
I met Ishti out at an open mic night in downtown Durham. He was carrying around his guitar and covered in oil paint, as he usually is, and connected with him because he looked like an artist, and there we had something in common. He had also met my former business partner, John, at another artist friend's house, and had been very – John was very impressed with Ishti's passion for the art, so had mentioned him to me.
Mm-hmm. And what made you decide to put his work in the gallery?
Ishti applied. So in 2013, artists have applied for shows, a pretty basic application process, but we got over 100 submissions this year for about 24 slots. And Ishti's work was selected because our space is really about community building, and Ishti's work is really about that too. The way he carries himself, the way he carries his story, the accessibility of his art really caters to our mission. And the quality of it is quite impressive as well.
Ishti, what inspires your work?
Everything. It's kind of the energy that people convey or project towards me. It's always been a place of refuge for me to exercise my innermost thoughts about life.
It's interesting you say that. We say always, but not really until you were diagnosed, right? So that you began painting. Until then, you really weren't expressing yourself that way, right?
Not until I was diagnosed.
I wonder how things changed for you. Once you began painting, there are these expressions that were now available to you that before then you were certainly experiencing, I would guess, some kind of bipolar episode. You just hadn't been diagnosed. Is that fair, or did it come on all at once?
I think something changed in the hospital, though, and I think that's what you're asking. What was that shift? And I'll give you the perfect example. I've always wanted to... I've admired the masters, if you will, and I've always wanted to paint like Monet or paint like Van Gogh or Salvador Dali or what have you. But what I've realized in the hospital, which is critical, is the fact that I have to paint like Ishti. And that was the driving force behind it. And when I went to Appalachian State, I had an exhibition there in one of the classrooms of the work that I did in the hospital. And one of the professors that traveled from UNC to see the exhibition said that if you go to a museum, per se, and you see a Dali or you see a Monet or a Van Gogh, you can always recognize that it's a Van Gogh or a Monet because it's a signature. So she said to me that Ishti, I'll always recognize an Ishti. So that kind of put me on the road towards art.
Mm. Let me ask you, Laura, as a curator and someone whose job it is to find art and present it to the public, because, you know, so people are always asking this question, what distinguishes it as art, right? And Ishti's work, at least the pieces you brought here, are not representational, right? So then the question is, what is it that you see? Ishti's talking about a soul, a signature, an identity that finds itself on every canvas, even though each picture is different. What do you see and how do you recognize that?
It is that. I mean, describing it as this soulful thing is really accurate. You can feel Ishti's passion and you can see his story. And he also wears that on his sleeve. I mean, some artists are kind of wary of telling their personal story in addition to displaying their work. But Ishti is telling his story verbally, you know, as he's meeting people in the gallery. He's telling it through his paintings. He's telling it through his music. And the Carrick is really a great space for that kind of sharing to happen. And so, yeah, I think that it was that Ishti's work is striking in its authenticity. It is so Ishti.
Do the people who come to the museum... Can they tell that? They don't have a professional eye necessarily without the story.
I think they can. I mean, his show was so well attended and so well received, and other people were sharing their stories with each other and with Ishti. I think I saw that happen a few times when Ishti was not present too. And I think there's something about the openness and the energy behind Ishti's work that makes people want to delve a little deeper into themselves as well.
Well, yeah, go ahead.
Well, you know, with regards to that, Phil Lesh once said that why be an artist if your life's not an open book? And ever since I heard that quote, I've tattooed that without any tattoos on my body, on my heart. Hmm. You know, so
Phil Lesh of the Grateful Dead,
yep.
One who knew, yeah. I mean, so, authenticity in art, yeah.
With regards to Ejabet, this piece that I have here that's green, it's my masterpiece. There'll never be one like it. I'm kind of like my mother.
You know, describe the piece for us.
It's basically my mother's soul ripping a sword out of the sea in triumph over cancer. And also it depicts my grandmother holding a baby I lost 6 years ago. And that was a messy situation that I'll never want to go through again, and I don't wish on anyone. So, and it's got me reaching for her breast for comfort, you know, and so it's a complete representation of my life until that point, and I think that's why it reflects and draws emotion out of people like it did with Lee, Brian Stoner's significant other. Mm. You know, she lost her...
This was an individual who came to one of the Carrick events and saw this piece and felt very moved and also felt compelled to share her story with Ishti at that time.
She said that a lot better than I was going to.
Well, tell us about how long did it take you to paint that?
3 minutes and 20 seconds.
Are you kidding?
No.
Did you see it all at once?
No. Basically, it was 8 understudies. Her wings were once a water lily.
You're talking about this picture?
Yeah.
And you saw that's the picture you were imagining as
you know what's funny you said that? Imagine came on when I was sitting there painting it.
Huh.
So imagine no heaven, no hell below us, above us only sky. Guess whose picture's over my bed? John Lennon. That came from Robert from the Carrick, who used to be a photographer there. It's the only existing print of that. So
Imagine is a song, of course, John Lennon. We all know it. How much does music play a part in your imagination how much of your work comes from visual imagination? How much is auditory? How much of it is verbal? How much of it is a word like imagine?
It's kind of like this biopsychosocial perspective. It's all of it.
All of it at once.
Yeah, I'm channeling something greater than I know, and it's something we try to define, and we have through, like, the history of time, and there's been wars waged and so on and so forth because of that, because of the differences. And the most important thing we have to realize as human beings, not as artists. Artists are the vessels, we're the conduits. But as human beings, we all bleed red.
When you paint a work like this, and you talked about your mother's battle with cancer,
right.
The child that you lost, your
right.
grandmother's breasts.
She
right?
died the day I broke my back. My grandmother did.
How much, when you're putting that work on the canvas, right, what's happening to you? Is it a release for you? Is it therapeutic? Are you feeling better, or is it hell for you?
It's the clearest moment in my life. Like, when blind people can't, you know, recognize vision, but they have other senses. I think I've developed a sense to project my innermost emotions in order to move people, whether it's through song or art.
I'm going to ask you this question first, then I want to ask Laura, because there is, and you heard me ask the question to Pam Gutlin, the outsider art question, how much of the story of the visionary is important to us in outsider art, a sense that the artist is in touch with something that we don't feel. So let me ask you this question. Do you feel that people react to you differently or react to your art differently because they know your story, because you have what we call a disorder that they don't have, and maybe you're in touch with something that we don't
have? Yeah, we call it a disorder, but in some cultures I would have been a shaman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's all relative. Einstein got it right. You know?
Well, Laura, I'm sorry. What's your sense of the way the average patron and art goer takes in this story, the sense that the artist is in touch with something else?
I think people seek that. They want this sort of mystery surrounding. And when I say people, I'm non-artists or people who think they're not artists. I kind of think we're all artists. But people who consider themselves non-artists want this sort of mystery surrounding the person creating things that they don't understand. So I do see that happen some. Though I have to say that it's pretty typical for people to not read the information.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen people completely connect to nothing but the object and the image over and over and over again. So I don't think that that mystique surrounding the person is vital to the experience of the work itself.
And you know how they're taking art out of schools and how people don't agree with it? Well, you know what? It's neither here or there. And it's because as a community, it is our responsibility to teach our children, not schools. It's not the school's responsibility. So I think creating an art community within this beautiful city of Durham would be, which is already happening, would be upright and is needed.
In many ways, that art community, if you think about its value, one of the things it does is give permission to all of us to not only appreciate art, but maybe produce art.
Right.
Right. And I'm wondering if you think back to all of the things that were happening to you, the crises in your life, including the diagnosis, is that what gave you permission to be an artist? And there's a second part to this, which
is causality.
It caused it.
Yeah.
You don't think you'd be an artist if it weren't for all those things?
Well, I think everybody's an artist. Mm-hmm. It's our choice to be expressive. It's our, you know, I chose to tell everybody that I meet that I'm bipolar. That's no joke. And it's no joke, and it's not a mystery either. Why did I do that? Because Dr. Thrall, my psychiatrist at Duke when I was first diagnosed and through many therapy sessions, told me, look, you need to build a safety net. And accepting the disorder day one was crucial. And since then, I've lived by that.
Frank, you talk about permission being given. And one of the best things about Ishti's exhibit at the Carrick is that he hosts open workshops where he invites the public to come in, watch him create work, and actually make work along with him. And I do think that Ishti's presence gave permission to those individuals, some of them who had never painted before,
right,
to create work right alongside and get in touch with their creative side and their creative story as well.
Ishti Kaldor is a painter based in Durham. Laura Ritchie is curator at the Carrick Modern in Durham. And that's our program for today. Take a look at the art we've been talking about at our website, wunc.org. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stasio.
I've been searching for so long. Trying to move past all this pain. And I can sense deep down in my soul. That the tears this evening will bring rain. So be my. Depth of my soul, we can go fly.